one of our, it's a little loud. In one of our Zen texts, there's a line that goes, Yi, fellow named Yi. Yi, with his archer's skill, could hit a target at 100 paces. But when arrow points meet head on, what has this to do with the power of skill? There's a backstory to this line, and the backstory is it refers to a story in Chinese lore where there was a master archer and his student, and after some years of working with his master, the student got it into his head to try to kill his master. So he fired an arrow in the direction of his master, and his master quickly fired another arrow toward him, and the arrow points met head on and fell harmlessly to the ground. After which the student apparently repented. So, despite this kind of gruesome backstory, the line in the chant is meant to illustrate this principle of alignment, of perfect meeting between master and student, and also perfect meeting between sentient beings in Buddhas. So, in the traditional presentation of Buddhism, there's three large categories which are said to summarize the Buddhist path. And in the traditional language of early India, these three are called sila, samadhi, and prajna. Sila meaning morality or ethical values, ethical conduct. Samadhi meaning our practice of zazen, meditative immersion, concentration, meditative merging, and prajna, which is wisdom. So, merging our understanding, the understanding of sentient beings and the thinking and emotional life of sentient beings with Buddha's wisdom. So, in Zen, we put a kind of emphasis, or at least it seems, it always seemed to me at the outset of my engagement with Zen anyway, and probably it was just what I was most interested in, and it seemed like these Zen people were most interested in it too, was sitting meditation. It seemed like when I encountered Zen, what people really wanted to do was sit meditation, and they wanted to see something. They had an impression from their reading and their drug experiences. They had an impression that there was some reality, some true reality that went below, deeper, more profound than the surface emotional and intellectual life that they spent in their daily lives. So, and of course, you know, the founding story of Zen kind of encourages this view that Zazen is really, or Samadhi is really, of those three that I mentioned, Samadhi is king, as it were, because the founding teacher, after a kind of rough encounter with the Emperor of China, and maybe fearing for his head, went off to Shaolin Temple and sat facing a wall for 9 years. This is the founding story of Zen from Bodhidharma's biography. So this practice of wall sitting, which we kind of can somewhat replicate here in this room, not quite in the traditional way, but we do our best, has assumed kind of number one spot in Zen, or in the apparently, on the surface at least, of Zen practice. And, you know, it is true, and I think it is true that what is so attractive about sitting meditation is that we have some direct experience of Buddha's wisdom. We have some direct experience of calming and settling and insight into the obstacles, the waves on top of the great ocean, as it's sometimes referred to. And sometimes when I'm sitting, and I think sometimes when you're sitting, you feel this kind of direct connection, this kind of alignment, that nothing is out of place, that everything is just as it should be, and that there's a feeling, a pervading feeling of harmony and ease. Now, if I say that, then people may want to go looking for that in their practice. They may compare their practice to that kind of description, and they may say, "Oh, I haven't had that kind of experience. I haven't had that," and they may then have some dissonance there. So we have to be careful about that kind of talk. But nevertheless, you know, Dogen does say this sitting meditation practice is the Dharma gate of joy and ease. So the invitation here today and always is, if this Dharma gate of joy and ease opens to you, please step right through. Enjoy the practice. Enjoy to have the arising of joy and have the arising of ease is actually the description of the first jhana, the first meditative concentration, joy and ease. So if that kind of feeling arises, just step right through. This is sometimes called the self-fulfilling samadhi. Samadhi of self-enjoyment. So it's okay, you know, if this kind of alignment, that kind of alignment comes up, then just join it. And if it's something else, it's whatever your sitting reveals. Zazen is not a certain feeling. It's not the arising of a certain feeling that it becomes a marker of the right way or the right attitude in sitting. It's not a certain feeling. So the second the second. The second is sila, or practice of ethical values, ethical conduct. So when we are, this is mainly a practice for off the cushion. This is a practice precepts are a practice for how do we take our practice and our alignment with Buddha's wisdom into the world. And there are three suggestions. The first is first suggestion is do no harm. Don't do anything harmful. Act in the world with non-violence and non-harming. Last night I was motivated to, there was a picture on the front of the paper of a movie, of the entertainment section of the paper, and it was a picture of a movie, and the picture of the movie was two men with pistols pointed right at you. And so I decided to act in the world. I decided to act in the world on behalf of non-harming and non-violence. And I looked in the Sacramento Bee, and I got all the email addresses of the publisher, and they're all right there, you know, the publisher and the editor in chief and the vice president and so forth. And I just typed an email, and I said, you know, 1 week or less after people are gunned down in our state, you put this image on your paper. Can you please consider this? Can you please consider not showing these images of gratuitous violence? Could you please consider that? Could you please make a policy about that and just say, we won't do that? It's not appropriate. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that arises, you know, that kind of action arising out of your practice. That's practicing non-harming and non-violent. I didn't get mad at the people who put the paper on there, put the picture in the paper that way. I wasn't angry in my message. I just said, consider. Please consider the impact of opening my paper and seeing these guns pointed at me after these three people are killed and 12 are wounded by a deranged person. Please consider this. So we have, you know, these kind of opportunities to act on the behalf of non-harming and non-violence. And then the second, I'm referring here to what are called the pure precepts. So the first one is don't do any harm. The second one is do everything you can think of that's good for you, that's good for other people, that's good for our society, whatever it is, do all good, and please do it, you know. There's an invitation to do it, not just sit, you know. But actually do something. So we have to be, you know, careful about what is good, and also, you know, there's some questions about that. We have to be very, you know, careful in our thinking about what we consider is good for, especially other people. We have to be careful about that kind of thinking, and really consider. And maybe even ask them, if I did such and such for you, would you think it was good? If I said such and such to you, would you think this was good? So we have to be careful, but still, that's what the precept says. Do all good. And then the third pure precept says, save all sentient beings. What does that mean? Well, I'm just going to say this morning, and it's not the definitive description of what that means, but I would just say, help everybody that you can. Just help everybody that you can, and if there's somebody that needs help or needs your friendship or needs, something, just be available if you have the energy. If you don't have the energy, then you have to take care of yourself too. So be kind to yourself. Save yourself maybe first, that old thing. But that's the third pure precepts. Precept. And these are the ways that we can take our, this is the suggestion from the Buddhist path about how to take our practice off the cushion into the world and be of benefit. So the third on the third description of the Buddhist path is called wisdom, or prajna. It's a special kind of wisdom, and it's a wisdom about knowing the self and what the self is, and if there and correctly describing what is taken for a self and what is not taken for a self. So, there's this description in the world today of wisdom, and it's called the view from 30,000 feet. Have you ever heard that? The view from 30,000 feet. It's like the view out of an airplane window. So when you're flying over the country, if you go on a flight, you're basically cruising at 30,000 feet or 35,000 feet. That's called cruising altitude. And what you see from cruising altitude, you don't see individual people. There's no individual people to be seen on Earth. There are only the people in the plane, no individual people on Earth. What you see from 30,000 feet is just patterns of the mountains, the rivers, cities. You see patterns of cities. You see patterns of fields. It's often very beautiful, seeing the different circles and squares that if you go over the Midwest, there's all these patterns of fields. You don't see anything other than those patterns, and there's also a tendency to feel, this view is really peaceful, and I just don't see what all the problems down there are all about. So when you're up there, it's hard to see. What are all the problems about? It looks so peaceful. It looks so orderly. It looks so beautiful. So anyway, when I thought of this analogy, I thought of, there's a certain translation. We use a certain translation at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, which we're going to chant a little later. We use a certain translation of the first line, but and you'll hear the first line later, but there's another translation, which I'm going to tell you now, which is that the other translation is that Avalokiteshvara, who's the Bodhisattva of compassion, looked down from on high, looked down from all on high, and saw that all five skandhas are empty. So this is like Avalokiteshvara at 30,000 feet. He looks down and he looks down at beings. He actually sees beings, or she sees beings, and she sees that, oh, actually there are no beings. Just like when I'm at 30,000 feet, I don't see any beings. Avalokiteshvara doesn't see any beings. All that Avalokiteshvara sees is five categories called form, feeling, conceptualization, karmic formations, and kind of a generalized consciousness. So Avalokiteshvara looks down and sees there's just those five patterns. There are no beings. And even those patterns aren't fixed or permanent. Even those patterns aren't fixed or permanent. So, further riffing on my analogy of the plane, when you're on a transcontinental flight, eventually yours are flying. Oh, Alexei just flew over the ocean. I'm sure he experienced this. Eventually, you may take off in the light, but eventually, it's going to get dark. And when you're flying in the light, of course, you see the patterns down below. But when the sun sets, or the plane actually sets the sun, in a way, you know, it's kind of a cooperative thing between the plane flying and the earth turning. When the sun sets, even the patterns disappear. No patterns. And you're just flying in the dark. So, you know, Buddha's way, this is the hook back to wisdom. Buddha's way is flying in the daylight from 30,000 feet, seeing the patterns, seeing our patterns of thinking, seeing our emotional life, seeing our karma, seeing our conceptualizations, seeing that we have a body that's changing all the time. We have perceptual apparatus that's also changing all the time, becoming more or less effective all the time, mostly less. So the Buddha way is like the transcontinental flight. Some of it's in the light of discriminative consciousness, and some of it is in the dark. And this practice that we do on the cushion is this practice in the dark, where the patterns disappear. But we have to have both. We have to fly. We have to see patterns, and we don't have to do anything. But I'm suggesting that our practice includes this idea of flying in the daylight, seeing those patterns, and flying at night, where the patterns disappear. If you want to go over the great undifferentiated ocean, you have to fly in the dark. If you want to go over that great undifferentiated ocean, you have to fly in the dark. But then, even as you do, eventually the sun is going to come up again and you're going to be back in the world of discrimination, of seeing patterns, and there's no, we don't put a greater value on flying in the dark or flying in the light. They are the path. There seem to be some people in this world that seem to be able to stay in, you know, the mode of discriminative consciousness all the time. And I was thinking of the presidential candidates that I've been watching on TV. You know, I don't think they have time for Zazen. I think they have to spend all of their time totally engaged in the pattern world. They have to be totally engaged in the pattern world, and maybe they are very special people. No doubt, they are very special people and very, you know, concentrated people, and so they have maybe this capacity to do that, and they can stay sane. They can actually stay sane while doing it, which is pretty remarkable that there are such people that don't need this time in the dark to balance their life. I'm not one of those people, not running for president. I need this practice of non-discrimination, non-discriminative awareness, or at least pointing myself in that direction, giving myself, you know, time to point in that direction. There's no heaven, you know, in Buddhism. But there are, according to our understanding, according to this translation of the, I told you, of the Heart Sutra, there are bodhisattvas, there are enlightening beings that look down from on high, look down, and they see Buddha's wisdom. They restate. You know, when Avalokiteshvara looks down from on high and sees the five skandhas and that they're empty, he is restating, you know, really this is the very first teaching of the Buddha, and perhaps the most revolutionary. Certainly the most revolutionary teaching of the Buddha. There is no self. There is no fixed and permanent self. And so when Avalokiteshvara looks down, she sees exactly what the Buddha saw. And also he sees these patterns and sees that they are not fixed or permanent. So my suggestion for us today is that we, baby bodhisattvas, have the opportunity and this practice available to us to also to look down. We look down just a few feet in front of our nose, you know, just a few feet in front of our nose. But as we do that, through that practice, we become allies of Buddha. We align ourselves with Buddha teaching, and we become Buddha's ally, and we become the ally of the Bodhisattva of compassion as well, and her marvelous work in the world. So this is the invitation today to Form an alliance. Form an alliance, align, ally. These words all seem to be related to each other. A great ah sound. I know om is like the first sound, but I think also ah is the first sound. So align, become an ally of Buddha. This is our great invitation, our great capacity, actually, to become an ally of Buddha and to act in the world on her behalf. Align our activity, align our values, align our thinking, align our posture. Align our breath.